Welcome to our podcast at agendadigitale.eu.
Welcome to Secure in Mind, the podcast based in Italy, hosted by Alessandro Longo's Cybersecurity 360, narrated and produced by Nick Kelly. And it's a format where we are able to, or where we discuss interesting technology developments, quite focused on cybersecurity, but we also explore ethics within technology development, equality, and the necessity for that to be in place as part of a structure and a fabric within technology development and society in more broad terms. And today we have a fantastic guest. I'm really excited to interview Keren. To give you a bit of a list of her biography, she was ranked in 2007 Forbes 22nd Most Influential Women in Israel. She is a senior researcher at the Blavatnik Interdisciplinary Cyber Research Center. She's a co-founder of B-Sides, which is a very cool event we'll explore during the discussion. And she's also a faculty member of the Singularity University. So without further ado, I'm very, very honored to have Keren Elazari as our guest. Welcome, Keren.
Hi, Nick. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast today.
Pleasure's all ours. How's the day going so far?
It's fantastic. I'm enjoying my time here in sunny Tel Aviv. I should point out that I am the co-founder of B-Sides Tel Aviv, which is part of a global network of events called B-Sides. So I did not found the original B-Sides, which started almost 10 years ago, originally in Las Vegas. I did found the Israeli chapter or the Israeli franchise of the Security B-Sides movement. I'm happy to talk a little bit more about that and what it means for our local community here.
Okay, thank you for the clarification. I was I was actually thinking B-Sides was originally from the States. So yeah,
that
makes more sense. Okay, so look, you and I met initially at Cyber Week in Tel Aviv. By the way, love the city. many fond memories. Want to be back there soon. I guess a big part of this podcast is to disseminate and the information that we discuss in some of these industry events, and bring it into plain speak into the public, so that there can be a bit of a considered debate, discussion, formed conversation about issues that are affecting us in the tech sense, and see if, you know, we can affect change and affect a greater awareness. So I guess often what I do is run through the speaker's background, what got you interested in the industry, and so that it's kind of relatable to the everyday person, and you know, when they're going through, I guess, their youth and they're identifying things that they like, etc. So do you want to give us a quick sort of walkthrough as to how you came to be where you are?
Absolutely. So I'll be honest, I was always a very, very curious, somewhat mischievous child, and I always had a lot of questions to my parents, to my teachers. I spent a lot of time trying to investigate and uncover the answers to all of my questions. Even as a kid, I would crawl under tables to see, you know, where the cables that were connecting some device, where they went to. I would poke, I would push buttons, I would poke fingers into holes and things. I would constantly have questions. I was very curious about my surroundings.
Were you electrocuted?
No. Thankfully, no. I grew up in rather a safe environment, so wasn't.
Good.
But my father was and still is an electrical engineer. So it did have a lot of gadgets lying around the house. And he'd often have, you know, first generation gadgets, for example, one of the first mobile phones in Israel, one of the first cellular phones. This is back, you know, when the phones were very, very big. Or perhaps, you know, it was like a Palm Pilot, one of those PDAs. So he'd have a lot of these gadgets. And as soon as he got past them into the second generation or third generation, because he was always an early adopter, he'd always have the first generation of whatever device it was. After he got past it and moved on, I would get those legacy devices and I would play around with them and sometimes take them apart and try and put them back together. As a kid, I had robots. You know, the Transformers was a big show on television, and I had robots that I loved taking apart and putting back together. And of course, I also had toys and other pursuits, just like any other normal little boy or girl. But I was always really, really curious about things, and specifically curious about technology. Mm. And I grew up, thankfully, in Tel Aviv, in Israel, in a country, in a city where innovation and technology is a big part of our, you know, it's a big part of our culture and it's a big value. And so I was lucky enough, I was privileged to grow up in a school that had a very early robotics lab for the kids to experiment with programming robots. And we had a computer lab. And so in the year 1993, when we first got the internet in Israel, I heard about the internet and I begged my parents to get my own computer with an internet connection. And once that happened, you know, back in those days, you'd call the ISP and the internet was using a phone line and they'd send you, you know, maybe they send you the modem or maybe already had the modem in your device, in your computer. And they sent a CD or a disc with the software to use it and, you know, browse the internet. But really, there wasn't a lot of explanation on how should you use these things. So I pretty much uncovered it by myself. And I taught myself, first of all, how to, you know, make sure that the drivers for the modem worked and how to make sure that I connected to the internet. And once I was online, I taught myself what the internet was. I thought I kind of stumbled on websites and then I wanted to learn how they were built, how they were made. So I also started looking at their source code, usually, you know, just very simple HTML, maybe sometimes PHP, very, very early in the days of PHP. And I taught myself a little bit on how to build that code or copy other people's code and restructure it for my own needs. And I wrote my own website. And very early on, I discovered that for a lot of my questions, I could find answers online for my curiosity, for my investigations. But sometimes those answers would be in password protected sites, or they would be in, you know, in forums that I had to be over 18 to get into, or they would be in all kinds of places where they weren't as accessible on the surface of the web. And this is before the age of Google. So you'd have to really, you really needed to crawl around the internet quite a lot to find things. There wasn't really a search engine per se as Google. Yahoo was in its early days. It was more like a directory. So in a way, the experience of the World Wide Web back then is more similar perhaps to what the dark web looks like today for people, that they needed to have a specific URL that they surf to, and then they need to know exactly what type of thing they're looking for, and they usually use directories to find their way in websites. And that was the experience of exploration for me. And within that experience, there was also somewhat the experience of getting past those password protections and understanding how they work. And I just taught myself a lot of things. I stumbled onto things. I learned how to do them. And I didn't really realize that what I was doing was actually hacking.
It's a great point there. And back a bit, when you're saying, let's say, for example, we don't have the Google. For the listeners out there, what do you mean by saying you need to input a URL specifically? And how do you do that? Because maybe that sounds like a word of mouth thing. You need to know exactly the numerals that you're putting in. Or are you just guessing and changing it with each keystroke? You know, you type in A, you type in B, you type in C. How does that work?
Well, back in the day, if I wanted to, for example, find some websites, I would need to know how to type in Yahoo and type in specifically into my browser location bar Yahoo, you know, www.yahoo.com. And then I would get a list of topics. It wasn't like a search engine at all. There would be topics like, for example, comedy or cats or water skiing, whatever topic
cats.
Cats were originally, you know, one of the first killer applications, I think, for the World Wide Web. And I don't know. I don't think it's a coincidence that to this day, the pictures of cats and the dissemination of silly pictures of cats.
Absolutely.
Is very popular.
They've been on the pyramids. They rule the world when we're gone.
Yes. There are many theories on why there's such a prevalence of cat imagery. But definitely even back then, there were pictures of cats, I think. And then let's say that I wanted to go to a specific website. I remember one website that I used to go to, which was called, I think, The Island or Island, something like this. And I needed to just type in the address. There wasn't any Google. I needed to type in the full address, theisland.org or something like that. Or at the time, people had personal websites on this system called GeoCities. GeoCities was a site, I think later on it was acquired by Yahoo probably, or some other web conglomerate, and people could set up their own home pages on it. The homepage was, you know, kind of like what today would be your Facebook profile or your MySpace page earlier than that. You know, you'd say a few words about yourself, what you're interested in, almost like a blog. But this is before even the invention of blogs. And if you wanted to go visit somebody's website, they would have to give you the exact address, you know, geocities.com/ Brooklyn/9175/something like that. And you needed to type in that address exactly. Today, when people peruse and browse the darknet, a lot of the times they need to point their browser at a specific URL. There are several darknet sites which serve as directories in the same way that Yahoo was back in the day. So these are main sites that you surf to, and then you have a list of pointers or links to other more specific interest sites. Mm-hmm. And you need to have that particular URL to be able to point your browser to. So it's a little bit different to the experience of browsing, or for example, Googling for everything, which is what most people do these days. I don't think there's very few people on the planet actually use the internet without the mediation of a massive search engine such as Google, or in certain cases, Bing by Microsoft. But Google is really the market leader in that. Yeah. So that was my early experience. And then very early on, as I mentioned, I started, you know, bypassing password protections by a few different mechanisms. I learned a little bit about PHP and its vulnerabilities, and how you could sometimes, if there is a login page for a site which utilizes PHP, I learned some very, very early tricks on how to just bypass it and get into the site that was protected by the password. And when the first time I was able to do that, I felt extremely powerful. Mm. And around that same time, you know, these are the 90s that we're talking about. In the year 1995, something really life-changing happened to me, which is the film Hackers that came out.
One of the best films ever made.
I agree with you. And I think it was really good in a variety of ways. But, you know, there's quite a lot of people that would tell you that from a technical point of view, or from a narrative and dramatic point of view, it's not one of the best films.
Well, let's just say that some of the lines don't actually make sense technologically.
Yeah, so I agree with you. Some of the technology stuff doesn't make sense. Some of the dramatic narrative is, you know, very much exaggerated. However, for me, when I was 14 and I watched that movie, everything lined up perfectly.
Yeah.
That movie described this counterculture. They described this group of, you know, high school weirdos. At the time, I was a big geek, a very big, you know, weirdo. I didn't even the kids that were playing Dungeons and Dragons didn't let me join their team. Because I was that much of a weirdo. I'd spend a lot of time, you know, playing computer games, or spending time at the school library or the school lab or at home with my computer. And I really, you know, resonated with the messages in that movie, that these kids, these high school kids, and namely that one of them is a girl like I was, and she had short hair like I had in the time, and that she was portrayed by the fierce, you know, charismatic Angelina Jolie. The fact that somebody as cool and as awesome as that young hacker portrayed by Angelina Jolie, that she could be a hero of the story, using her hacking skills, using her knowledge, using her intellectual capability to change the outcome and, you know, prevent an ecological catastrophe, uncover a corporate corruption, show the FBI who the real criminal is. You know, they were the real heroes of that movie. Mm. So for me, it was a real eye-opening moment, because I instantly realized that everything I enjoyed doing, and that my passion, my curiosity, is something that is called being a hacker, and that there are other high school kids that are hackers around the world. And it's not just an Israeli thing, it's not just an American thing, that it's a global movement or a global counterculture. And I immediately wanted to be a part of it. So I started looking for online chat rooms and IRC groups. IRC is one of the earlier chat systems that's still around, and it's text-based chat system. And I used to look for the chat rooms where hackers were. So for example, I joined a group for Linux users, because a lot of the hackers would use Unix and Linux. And then I had to learn how to use Linux, and I had to teach myself. I also started a job, and it was my last year of high school, and I had a couple of months off, and I marched down to the local computer store, the same store that had all of the video games and computer games that I loved going to see the demos of. And I just walked into the same store and I told the manager, you need to hire me. And I, you know, argued, I negotiated my way to get a job, even though I was the youngest employee at the store. Mm. And I started learning more also about hardware, because at that store we would offer custom built PCs. So I had to learn about all of the different PC parts and the customizations, and learn, you know, some things about hardware. And back in the day, it was a lot about the 3D hardware acceleration, so graphics cards for games. So, you know, I should actually say that gaming and the computer game world was always a big part also of my background and what motivated me to go deeper into this world. And as you know, especially in the 90s, but even today, there are always cheat codes, Easter eggs, secret levels in computer games. So in a way, spending a lot of time with the computer games also invoked and encouraged me to explore, you know, how the system works, what's the technology behind it, so that I could unlock the cheat code or unlock the secret level in the game or figure out a way, you know, this is more than 20 years ago, so I allow myself to speak freely, figure out a way to copy a game or, you know, give a copy to my friend or sometimes play a game that was designed for older, more adult audiences. So games that were for 18 year olds and had all kinds of protections on them that I had to bypass. And it was always a fun puzzle for me. I never felt like I was doing something criminal or illegal. It was always about the curiosity and solving that puzzle.
It's a great segue to bring us to one of the key pointers here. And this is something that, you know, we have a fellow close industry peer, Chris Roberts, who sometimes gets quite annoyed with people not being able to distinguish between hackers and criminals. It's mentioned when you're bypassing some of these protections. Now, these protections are put in place for, you know, 18-year-old plus games for a particular reason. There's been, court oversight to determine that for whatever reason, this game is not suitable to minors. Now, when you're bypassing those protections, what you're doing is you're breaking that policy or you're breaking, you know, whichever legislation was written to enforce that. However, when you look at that from the bigger picture, and we'll draw also from your famous TED talk about hackers being the internet's immune system, when you actually do bypass some of these control mechanisms, what you're doing is you're actually proving the insecurity of said control mechanisms, whereby, fingers crossed, pushing that company into increasing or upping their game to better the security, because whereas you're doing that just to, you know, to see if you can, there are other people who would be doing that for malicious reasons. And we're just talking about a game in this instance. There's obviously a myriad other types of technologies, innovations, moving things, big things like planes and things, that people would have the same kind of principles, curiosity to see whether they could bypass or, you know, in extreme cases, for terrorist activities in a state grid. So I'd love to get your thoughts on how the perception of the public has changed of in their view of hackers, especially, I guess your talk was, what, 2014? So even in the last 4 years, have you noticed a big perception change in how the public sees what a hacker does, who a hacker is, what their role is, the spectrum of roles? Because again, you know, there's black and white. Yeah, a bit of information about that.
Absolutely. So I definitely feel that since 2014, when I first presented this idea at TED, it was mid-2014. And when I was first invited to speak at TED was actually mid-2013. So the idea of inviting a hacker or presenting a different point of view about what hackers can represent for society back in mid-2013, I think it was quite avant-garde back at the time, maybe even a radical thought. And about a couple of weeks after I had received my invitation was about that same point in time that Edward Snowden came out with his revelations about what was going on at the NSA. And suddenly 2014, I think, became this turning point year and how the public views the issue of cybersecurity at large, and how more specifically we are reconsidering the roles of individual hackers, of organizations, and of government agencies in protecting all of us. And what, you know, suddenly there was a realization that perhaps the good guys and the bad guys were not who we thought they were, that it's not all as black and white as, you know, for so many years we had felt like. And for me, originally speaking, you know, even back through the 90s and throughout my career working within organizations, I'd always seen the term hacker as a term that I'm proud to use, a term for somebody who is very capable, who is very curious, who is very unique in their thinking and their mindset. And I would try, and I still do, try to differentiate very clearly between a criminal, a spy, a terrorist, and a hacker. And the capabilities of hacking can be used for a variety of things. They could also be used for, you know, political protests, for hacktivism. And that's just one application of that skill set. there, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence or just a fad or a trend that so many companies and organizations are also talking about hacking innovations, running hackathons, talking about growth hacking. So there's a reason, I believe, and this is primarily probably coming from Silicon Valley, but it's also taken hold in other cultures in other places in the world. There is definitely the mindset of hacking, which isn't necessarily nefarious or criminal. Yeah. It is innovative. It is perhaps counterintuitive or different to what mainstream thinking is. It's definitely a different point of view, an original, I like to hope, original perspective on things.
Which I've always embodied. Because that's, you know, the vocabulary or the terminology hack or to hack or a hacker has seeped into the general vernacular. So now it can be applied to a whole range of things, primarily saying, okay, look at this from outside the box, or how can this work in a different way that's not printed off on the back of the box.
But exactly. There's a website called
Lifehacker, though, which said how to hack a BLT sandwich. So sometimes it goes too far.
That's true. However, I definitely feel like in the past few years, that term hacker has been embraced more broadly, specifically the thinking about friendly hackers and what their contributions can be. And I'm quite proud to say that perhaps the idea that I shared back in 2014 was radical at the time, but now it's been embraced and adopted by many, many organizations and people. And I get responses from all over the world. The talk, the TED Talk was viewed more than 2.5 million times. It was translated to 30 languages. So I get reply every day, not a day goes by that I don't get a response from somewhere in the world, from somebody who has seen it. And he says, he or she or they say, you know, I'm thinking about hackers in a completely different light. And I want to be a hacker for good. I want to become that sort of person. I want to contribute using hacking capabilities to contribute to the safety of organizations, to contribute to democracy. So I'm you could call me an optimist in that sense, but I'm a very big believer in the power of stories and perspectives. And when I share that perspective, my perspective about hackers, I also encourage people to consider thinking about hackers and telling stories about hackers in a different way. We've also seen this in popular culture. So I think in the past 2 years, we've also seen a larger subset of hacker characters introduced in the media. So from things like Mr. Robot, which is a very popular show in the US, and that really showed a much more nuanced and much more technically accurate worldview of what a hacker or a hacker group can look like. We've also seen, you know, in the latest Ocean's 8 movie, Rihanna portrays a very cool hacker. Charlize Theron portrayed a hacker in the Fast and Furious film, although as a villain, as a bad guy. But again, it is a broader description, I think, of what hackers can represent. And we're also getting, I'm getting responses from people that are writing comic books about the potential, you know, friendly hackers that are out there. And of course, more importantly, perhaps than that, in business, in, you know, in the impact on businesses, the phenomena of bug bounty programs, which when I mentioned back in 2014, was still kind of new, was still something that only, you know, big Silicon Valley companies do, like Facebook or Google. So to clarify for the listeners of the podcast, a bug bounty program is, in other words, it's also called a vulnerability reward program. This is a framework that allows a company or an organization, let's say Facebook, for example, to actively engage with individual hackers that find vulnerabilities and bugs and problems in their code, in their website, in their applications, report about these findings, and receive a recognition and oftentimes also a monetary reward for their findings. And these programs, which originated just with a few Silicon Valley and technology companies, now there's, you know, 5% of global transportation companies have them, 20-something percent of financial institutions have them. There have been bounty programs from organizations as conservative as the United States Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security. They have their own bug bounty program. Airline companies have them. Car companies have them. Credit card companies have them. More and more organizations have realized that there is a lot of value to be had by actively inviting and engaging the attention of friendly hackers. And the platforms, the websites that mediate, the platforms that make this possible, and this was the subject of my research work at Tel Aviv University in the past 3 years, looking at the value that's created by these programs. The platforms that enable this interaction have listed on them hundreds of thousands. I believe one platform has more than 100,000 friendly hackers that are from all over the world. Oftentimes, by the way, these are people that are younger. They are under 30 years of age. They don't necessarily have a formal background or formal education, just like I didn't have when I was growing up in this space. And a lot of the times they are in countries around the world where they don't actually have, they don't have necessarily an industry, a cybersecurity industry or a college or some community that they could be a part of. So a lot of the times for them, joining and participating in bug bounty programs is the first time in their lives that they are getting legitimately, legally paid and acknowledged for security research work. And that's an alternative that did not exist before.
Yeah,
so when I grew up, something like that wasn't available.
Which isn't in the black market.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this is not just creating value for companies. My point and what I discovered in my research was that this is a phenomenon that's actually changing the face of the global security community, because it's creating a job opportunity, but not just an immediate job opportunity. It's also creating an on-ramp into the legitimate legal cybersecurity industry for a lot of people, for hundreds and thousands of people, or dozens of thousands, according to the reports that I've seen. And I believe that hundreds of thousands in the years to come.
And so
that's a really important phenomenon.
Yeah, no, it is. And I guess drawing from your research, do you have any sort of quantifiable data on the reduction of breaches, for example, in companies that are using bug bounty programs versus those that aren't?
That's a great question. So that's not a specific metric that I can point to, but I can point you in another metric, which is the fact that in the past year, in 2017, there was double the amount of vulnerabilities had been discovered. So from 2016 to 2017, there has been double the amount of vulnerabilities that have been reported and discovered. Of course, you have to also consider the fact that every day, every month, every week, companies create dozens of thousands of lines of code. So you could also argue that the amount of vulnerabilities that is being created is on the rise, not just the amount that is being discovered. However, my counter argument to that would be that as we embrace more and more technology and software is eating the world, as we are often told, then we need all the help we can get. And we need all the humans and all the automated technologies that also help uncover vulnerabilities. I can also tell you that the companies, I don't have any metrics on breach prevention. The companies that engage in cybersecurity programs and vulnerability reward programs quite often talk about it. And there is a variety of testimonials for companies that do this. They talk about what type of maturity they have been able to get out of having a program like that, because suddenly they have this outsider's perspective. Even companies like Google, for example, which, you know, arguably Google can hire the best security talent in the world and they can invest the best technological, you know, automatic measures to identify vulnerabilities. And yet each year, Google pays millions of dollars to outsider researchers as part of their vulnerability reward program. Not only that, from an analysis done on the vulnerabilities that they pay out, the ones that are found by outsiders, on average, the bugs and vulnerabilities discovered by outsiders are of higher criticality, higher severity than the ones that are discovered by the internal employees of the company. So there is great value there. Yes, that's true. So the point being is that even the most sophisticated, the most mature company in the world, when it comes to, you know, how much they can invest in their security operations, the talent that they can attract, the amount of attention that they can give to details, even that company finds great deal of value, and they find that the outsiders are finding the more critical, the more severe vulnerabilities. So that to me really brings that point home. And there's quite a lot more. We can talk just about that, you know, for the next couple of hours. There's quite there. I could punch you or your listeners if you'd like to. There's fantastic reports. We can summarize this topic by pointing out to the two top companies that are the platforms that create these marketplaces that mediate between the individual hackers and the companies that run the programs. The first one is called Bug Crowd.
Casey
Ellis, an Australian entrepreneur, absolutely right. Bug Crowd, they're one of the first, they're perhaps the biggest one. And HackerOne, which is the second one, they have perhaps the most hackers on their platform. And they often push out monthly or quarterly reports with a lot of the data points that could help people get a better understanding of why bug bounty programs are so useful.
And I'll pop that in the notes when the podcast is published for all the listeners who are interested in, especially in corporate environments, who are interested in engaging in one of those programs. Yeah, we could talk for hours on that subject because it is incredible initiative, and also it's been picked up by, you know, even the Pentagon, as you said, the DOD in the States. The Pentagon is running their second or maybe even third Hack the Pentagon. And again, you know, like Google, they've got some of the, you know, the brightest minds in the industry in security, and yet you can always use someone else's angle, a different perspective, and encourage them to identify these bugs because they're looking at it from a different light. This is it's a bit of a jump of a segue, but focus on women in tech. Now, I understand you wrote a chapter?
Or? Yes, I collaborated and I contributed a chapter to the book Women in Tech, which was published in 2016. The full name of the book is Women in Tech, A Practical Guide to Take Your Career to the Next Level. And it's available on Amazon and wherever fine books are sold. And also on my personal website, there's a button that will take you directly to the Amazon page for the book.
So we'll put your website obviously in the notes for the show as well. Now let's expand on the book. And prior to expanding on the book, this is a bit of a jump. I'll see if I can do it.
Okay.
I was looking at a tweet the other day from Katie Mazouras. Now, Katie Mazouras, for the listeners out there, she is another fantastic hacker who has set up a bug bounty program inside Microsoft.
She was a pioneer. I think Katie is a pioneer of bug bounty programs, and she trailblazed Microsoft's program, is one of the biggest programs in the world. And as soon as Microsoft launched it, it gave this green light to a lot of other companies to look at bug bounty programs. So I absolutely look up to her and her work on this space. And she's actually also one of the co-authors of the ISO, the International Standards Organization. There is a global ISO for coordinated vulnerability disclosure. Mm. And she's one of the authors of that standard. So she literally wrote the standard, you could say, on coordinated vulnerability disclosure.
Yeah, she literally wrote the book.
And, that's right.
And here's one of her tweets, because you know, I like you are very supportive of equality within within industry and also within society. But if we focus on industry, here's an interesting tweet that I read of hers, and I'd love to get your thoughts on it because I think it is quite relevant and it's a really interesting perspective from a woman in security, a woman in a corporate environment. So here's the tweet: TFW, your happy folks are celebrating others and you. And yet there's still an annoying focus on your least significant bit, nothing to do with your work. I'm so fucking sick of the women in lists. The equality I crave is that professional lists have plenty of unscripted diversity. And I think that's fantastic, because what she's pointing out there is there shouldn't be any need to point out that women are in security. It should just be a given. And so therefore, as much, the support for books like Women in Tech, I think we do need to push the dial. We need to shift the scales so it's made aware that women are in security and that it's an attractive environment to be in. But then a pushback from a woman in security is saying, why should we have to do that? It should just be showcased on, you know, our merit. So I'd love to get your thoughts from a tweet from a person who you look up to in bug bounties.
Sure. Yeah. Well, first of all, I absolutely admire Katie and I love her and for everything that she's done. We may not agree on everything, and that's absolutely fine, because there's space in our industry for a diversity of opinions as well as a diversity of mindset, ethnicities, genders, and everything else. Mm. Personally, I can tell you that from my personal experience, and I don't know about lists of women in, etc., but from my personal experience, at least here in Israel, one thing I did a couple of years ago is I realized that I was one of a few, very few women in cybersecurity in Israel. Mm. And despite the fact that we have a very big, very vibrant cybersecurity industry, and I realized that, you know, for many years when I was successful in my field, I was happy or perhaps content to be the only woman in security in Israel, or the first one that came to mind. And I was okay with that. And I felt comfortable with that position because it had, in my worldview back then, it helped differentiate me and my talents. Mm. Only later, and perhaps through my more international success and later on in my career, I realized that I would be personally much happier. And I think generally the community would benefit from having more women in the industry. And so I started to actively try and highlight the other women that are in that space. And for me, it was easier to highlight these women operating in cybersecurity within the context of talking just about women and not just talking about all of the professionals in the space. In Israel, we have this very, very big cybersecurity industry. If I were to highlight all of the professionals in the space that I admire, I would easily come away with a list that would be 90% men, just because of the way our industry is made up, you know, just because of the current makeup of it. However, I do wish to change that. I do wish to showcase to other women that there are role models within this space. I was very lucky growing up to see a film, a Hollywood movie with a female character portrayed by a Hollywood actress and decide that that is my accessible role model, decide that that's something I want to become. Not a lot of young girls get to see those types of role models, and they don't see, you know, there's no Acid Burn, which is the character of Angelina Jolie. Perhaps the modern day Acid Burn is Rihanna in Ocean's 8, but she portrays somebody who is quite clearly a criminal in that film. Or perhaps, you know, you could think about the girl with the dragon tattoo as another example of a famous hacker. If I had today, if I had a 12-year-old daughter, I don't know if I'd be comfortable telling her, oh, you should be like Lisbeth Salander. You should be like the girl with the dragon tattoo. Mm. Or you should be like Rihanna's 9-ball or 8-ball. That's the character in Ocean's 8, who is a criminal that, you know, gets away with millions of dollars in a heist. Mm. And so highlighting women within the space and celebrating their work, for me, has been a mechanism to showcase to other women, younger women, or, you know, women of all ages that are still starting their path in the career, showing to them that there is a variety of women in the space and there is a variety of role models available.
I side with you. I think it's imperative.
Well, it's not necessarily a question of size, right? We all have our different opinions. And I operate within the local community in Israel. So that's the point of view that I see. Here in Israel, I've found that it is beneficial to have lists of women that are successful in particular spaces. And then throughout these lists and throughout our global success, we are also able to shine a light on gender inclusivity and gender diversity, and generally on issues of inclusivity within the technology industry. Mm. Specifically, the book that we wrote, for example, the Women in Tech book, it's not just for women. So you could pick it up as well. And there's also a chapter in it about what it means to be an ally, what it means to be somebody that's trying to promote equality and diversity and inclusivity in the workspace. And it's also specifically, you know, we tried with that book to address some issues that are more relevant to women. For example, and this is again things that have been shown by vast amounts of research done by business schools like Harvard Business Schools and other business schools, showing that women, specifically in the technology industry, but also more broadly, don't negotiate their role and their salary and their terms in the same way that men do, that women are more hesitant to raise a red flag if a company's culture or a company's code of conduct is something that is not suitable for them. They won't necessarily leave a place of work that's not suitable to them, despite the fact that it might be harmful. So these are some things that we tried to touch on with the book. I join Katie's hope that one day we will all be celebrated, men, women, non-binary individuals, robots, aliens, you know, anybody would be celebrated within this industry, regardless of their gender identity, their ethnicity, or any other qualification or differentiator. Mm. Unfortunately, that's not the situation at the moment. So as far as I'm concerned, if I'm listed in some list, I'm happy to go with that, especially if it allows me to recommend other women to be in that list, or if it becomes a tool to show younger women that there are many role models. Specifically, you know, back in, I should say that I developed this more perhaps active feminist or more active point of view just a couple of years ago, just perhaps when I became more successful globally, I realized that I'm not happy being the only woman in the room anymore. And I'm not happy being the only woman that, you know, when you ask somebody in Israel, oh, are there any women in security? They'll just say Karen Elazari, she's it. I want them to say, oh, there are hundreds of women in cybersecurity in Israel, and they are successful, and they are founders of companies, and they are in high level positions in global companies and global organizations, and they are entrepreneurs, etc. And that's true. They just may not have received the same type of attention and limelight and recognition that I have. So what I try to do is when I encounter these lists, etc., I try to use that as a tool to shine the light at the other women that are on this, you know, in the space and are successful, but especially to show that as a way to create role model, accessible role models, many types of role models. You know, maybe I am a role model to somebody, but maybe Katie is a role model to somebody else. Or maybe, you know, we need a variety of other types of women that can become role models. So we have to show a lot of different types of role models if we hope to encourage a workspace and an environment that would include more different types of people within it.
Well, I think it's absolutely fantastic work that you're doing with women in tech, promotion of what women are doing in this industry, and hopefully bringing on a new generation where you've got a much more balanced workforce. So, yeah, massive applause from us at Secure in Mind. There's an interesting anecdote, which I'll touch on, that isn't cyber-related, but there's a fiscal concept called microfinance. It originated from Bangladesh. There was a guy called Dr. Muhammad Yunus, Nobel winner of economy.
Yes, of course.
A while ago. And long story short, so I don't babble on, the concept was flawed initially, they found out, basically, because they were giving them these micro-loans to the patriarch of the family unit. And once they started giving the money to the matriarch of the family unit, the money actually got spent where it was meant to be spent rather than on rice, wine, and gambling. Now, interestingly, if we draw that back into, say, a corporate sense, it's not just about women being in the industry, but also women being in pivotal roles where they do have ownership and executive authority. And, you know, we hope that some of the programs and the awareness that are more and more being pushed on now in corporate environments are actually not just paying lip service to this thing, but are actually inputting women into positions where they actually demand, you know, proper power and decision making, and with that they can affect some significant change as well. Because I think those mechanisms are necessary in order to fundamentally change this embedded corporate culture and societal culture. So
yeah, well, I could just comment on, you know, with regards to the, you know, the whole list thing. I should point out that it would be a positive future, and I absolutely look forward to it as well, where there are just, you know, if we have to have lists of humans that are successful in things, it would be just lists of human beings with regardless to their gender identity.
Yeah.
And more than that, I can relate, and I understand the frustration for certain successful women that at some point they don't wish to be included in these lists perhaps anymore if they don't really celebrate their work, if they only celebrate their gender identity. I can understand the frustration and where that's coming from.
Yeah,
for me,
you could see it would be a frustration. Yeah,
absolutely. You know, imagine that you'd only be listed just for your gender identity. That exactly. Could be really, it could feel belittling, and I understand that. For me personally, though, since I operate in a smaller community, which is here in Israel, I did find that creating groups and campaigns and awareness campaigns that are specifically targeted for women has been helpful for our community here in Israel. So back in 2015, I started together with colleagues and friends, very successful women in security. One of them is today a senior vice president of British Telecom, for example. Mm. So she's a senior vice president for British Telecom for security. Back in 2015, she started with me a group for women in security in Israel. And our goal is to have a professional meetup. And we meet once quarterly, sometimes once monthly, with talks and presentations by the women in the group on professional topics that they're dealing with. And it can be things like evaluating vulnerabilities, or recently we had a talk about introduction to reverse engineering. And the talks are, you know, very, very well received by the women in the audience, because finally they realize that there are other women like them in the industry, and it creates a space for them to network. And we also invite men, of course, into the audience. They're welcome to join. But the group is targeted for women, and it's called the Leading Cyber Ladies Group. So
just knowing that there are other women women in the industry just encourages it. It's a self-perpetuating cycle, right? That's fantastic.
Yeah, and the idea was that by creating this quote-unquote exclusive group, in the sense that it's exclusive for women only, or that the presenters are women only, we are actually hopefully contributing at large to a more inclusive industry and community. And for example, the companies that have hosted us, you know, companies like Microsoft, for example, or Palo Alto Networks, and, you know, Variety and Checkpoint, a variety of other big technology companies, they benefit from, you know, all of these women coming to their offices and engaging with their workforce and sharing their knowledge and their ideas. So far we've seen great success with this, and I'm hopeful we can continue the trend onward until we see a much more inclusive and equal workspace for all.
Fingers crossed, and let's hope that happens sooner rather than later.
Absolutely,
Karen, we're marching on in time. I could sit down and chat for hours and hours about this stuff. However, sadly, we're going to have to sort of look at the last section, which is basically what you're doing now. I sort of nicknamed it the shameless plug, just to get an insight of the activities, speaking engagements, events that you're attending, things that people should look out for. Yeah, sadly, we'll have to wrap up, which is what has been a very, very fantastic conversation.
So we just wrapped up last month. We wrapped up B-Sides Tel Aviv, which was our third event, and it was our largest event yet. We had more than 1,000 participants for B-Sides Tel Aviv. B-Sides is a local community event for the security research and friendly hacker community. It's part of the global hacker community called B-Sides. And just next week is B-Sides Las Vegas. I'll be heading over there very soon. That's the original B-Sides, the one that started it all. And this is, again, if you're listening from all over the world, I encourage you to check out and look for your local B-Sides event. You can do that on securitybsides.org. That's .org. And you can find your local event anywhere from Zurich to Colorado, Athens to Sao Paulo. There are cybersecurity events that are community-oriented. I'm very proud to have brought the first one to Israel. Mm. And that's what's on my agenda for next week. I'm also, of course, attending DEF CON, which is the largest hacker convention in the world. Yeah. We will be doing a book signing of the Women in Tech book over there. So if you are in attendance, come and see us at the No Starch Press in the vendor area at DEF CON. Okay. After that, I will be visiting with Singularity University at NASA Research Park, where I will be giving a guest seminar on the future of cybersecurity, which is one of my research topics. So looking at 3 years down the line, 5 years down the line, looking at how security issues in things like blockchain, AI, autonomous vehicles, automated infrastructure, IoT, trying to give a future outlook on all of these issues when it comes to security problems. So that's on my agenda as well. Other than that, I will be speaking later on this year at a few European events. I'll be at the Gartner Risk Summit in London, and then also at the ISACA Global, or I think European CSX event, that's also in London. And I will probably be in attendance in a couple other big events around the world. So I'm always traveling, trying to share my point of view, trying to share my research and my perspectives, and enjoying every minute.
Well, hopefully you make it to Italy during some of those travels. Italy or Australia, either one.
I will be in Australia, actually. I will be in Australia in November. So I've been asked to speak at the World Congress of Accountants, wow, which will take place in Sydney in November.
That's exhilarating.
Yeah, 8,000 people are expected there. So it should be quite a large event. I'm happy to share the stage with some great individuals. I'm actually quite happy that accountants and risk managers and auditors have recently started asking me to speak at their events, as well as financial institutions, because it really shows their willingness to learn from a different perspective.
Good sign of the times, isn't it? Yeah. Well, we've come to the end. Karen, thank you so much for everything you do for the industry, for everything you do for women in the industry, and the contributions that you've made to securing us, to securing the internet. And I hope everything goes well for you moving forward. And
thank you. Thanks so much, Nick.
No worries. Thank you again. And I hope to see you sometime soon, if not next year's Cyber Week in Tel Aviv for sure.
Absolutely. Cyber Week Tel Aviv next year will be bigger and better. We grow each year. And B-Sides is usually a part of that. So we hope to see you there.
Look forward to it. Thank you so much, Karen. Take care.
Thank you, Nick.
Ciao. Bye.
Ciao.
Welcome to our podcast at agendadigitale.eu.